May Tempest find a place in his field for your bones. De Bernazon tried futilely to match the iron gaze of Heathstock. He cleared his throat and spoke as loudly and confidently as he could.
When the towns are conquered and their wealth secured, you shall need one who knows the southern marketplace. I am that man.
At what price? Growled Heathstock.
A comfortable living, answered de Bernazon. A respected position, nothing more.
Bah! Snorted Heathstock. He would betray his own, he would betray us.
The giant king tore the axe from his belt and lurched at de Bernazon. Beor grimaced, knowing that this critical moment could defeat the entire plan. With his mangled hand, Heathstock grabbed de Bernazon's oily black hair and pulled the smaller man's head to the side, exposing the flesh of his neck. He swung his axe mightily at the target, his gaze locked onto the southerner's face. But even against the unbending rules of tradition, Beorg had rehearsed de Bernazon well for this moment. The little man had been warned in no uncertain terms that if he struggled at all, he would die in any case. But if he accepted the stroke and Heathstock was merely testing him, his life would probably be spared. Mustering all of his willpower, de Bernazon steeled his gaze on Heathstock and did not flinch at the approach of death. At the very last moment, Heathstock diverted the axe, its blade whistling within a hair's breadth of the southerner's throat. Heathstock released the man from his grasp, but he continued to hold him in the intense lock of his single eye.
"An honest man accepts all judgments of his chosen kings," de Bernazon declared, trying to keep his voice as steady as possible.
A cheer erupted from every mouth in Hengorot, and when it died away, Heathstock turned to face Beorg.
"Who shall lead?"
the giant asked bluntly.
"Who won the challenge of the song?" Beorg answered.
"Well settled, good king," Heathstock saluted his rival. "Together, then, you and I, and let no man dispute our rule."
Beorg nodded.
"Death to any who dare!"
De Bernazon sighed in deep relief and shifted his legs defensively. If Heathstock or even Beorg ever noticed the puddle between his feet, his life would certainly be forfeit. He shifted his legs again nervously and glanced around, horrified when he met the gaze of the young standard-bearer. De Bernazon's face blanched white in anticipation of his coming humiliation and death. The standard-bearer unexpectedly turned away and smiled in amusement. But in an unprecedented merciful act for his rough people, he said nothing. Heathstock threw his arms above his head and raised his gaze and axe to the ceiling. Beorg grabbed his axe from his belt and quickly mimicked the movement.
"Tempest!" they shouted in unison.
Then, eyeing each other once more, they gashed their shield arms with their axes, wetting the blades with their own blood. In a synchronous movement, they spun and heaved the weapons across the hall, each axe finding its mark in the same keg of mead. Immediately, the closest men grabbed flagons and scrambled to catch the first drops of spilling mead that had been blessed with the blood of their kings.
"I have drawn a plan for your approval," Beorg told Heathstock.
"Later, noble friend," the one-eyed king replied. "Let tonight be a time of song and drink to celebrate our coming victory."
He clapped Beorg on the shoulder and winked with his one eye.
"Be glad of my arrival, for you were sorely unprepared for such a gathering," he said with a hearty laugh.
Beorg eyed him curiously, but Heathstock gave him a second grotesque wink to quench his suspicions. Abruptly, the lusty giant snapped his fingers at one of his field lieutenants, nudging his rival with his elbow as if to let him in on the joke.
"Fetch the wenches," he commanded.
4. The Crystal Shard. There was only blackness. Mercifully, he couldn't remember what had happened, where he was. Only blackness. Comforting blackness. Then a chilling burn began to grow on his cheeks, robbing him of the tranquility of unconsciousness. Gradually, he was compelled to open his eyes, but even when he squinted, the blinding glare was too intense. He was face down in the snow. Mountains towered all about him, their jagged peaks and deep snow caps reminding him of his location. They had dropped him in the spine of the world. They had left him to die.
Akar Kessel's head throbbed when he finally managed to lift it. The sun was shining brightly, but the brutal cold and swirling winds dispelled any warmth the bright rays could impart. Ever was it winter in these high places, and Kessel wore only flimsy robes to protect him from the cold's killing bite. They had left him to die. He stumbled to his feet, knee-deep in white powder, and looked around. Far below, down a deep gorge and moving northward, back toward the tundra and the trails that would take them around the foreboding range of impassable mountains, Kessel saw the black specks that marked the wizard's caravan, beginning its long journey back to Luskin. They had deceived him. He understood now that he had been no more than a pawn in their devious designs to rid themselves of Morkai the Red. Eldaluk, Dendibar the Mottled, and the others. They'd never had any intentions of granting him the title of wizard.
"How could I have been so stupid?" Kessel groaned.
Images of Morkai, the only man who had ever granted him any measure of respect, flashed across his mind in a guilt-driven haze. He remembered all the joys that the wizard had allowed him to experience. Morkai had once turned him into a bird so that he could feel the freedom of flight, and once a fish to let him experience the blurry world of the undersea. And he had repaid that wonderful man with a dagger. Far down the trails, the departing wizards heard Kessel's anguished scream echoing off the mountain walls. Eldaluk smiled, satisfied that their plan had been executed perfectly, and spurred his horse on. Kessel trudged through the snow. He didn't know why he was walking. He had nowhere to go. Kessel had no escape. Eldaluk had dropped him into a bowl-shaped, snow-filled depression, and with his fingers numbed beyond feeling, he had no chance of climbing out. He tried again to conjure a wizard's fire. He held out his outstretched palm skyward, and through chattering teeth uttered the words of power. Nothing. Not even a wisp of smoke. So he started moving again. His legs ached. He almost believed that several of his toes had already fallen away from his left foot. But he didn't dare remove his boot to verify his morbid suspicion. He began to circumnavigate the bowl again, following the same trail he had left behind on his first pass. Abruptly, he found himself veering toward the middle. He didn't know why, and in his delirium, he didn't pause to try and figure it out. All the world had become a white blur, a frozen white blur. Kessel felt himself falling. He felt the icy bite of the snow on his face again. He felt the tingling that signaled the end of the life of his lower extremities. Then he felt warmth. Imperceptible at first, but growing steadily stronger. Something was beckoning to him. It was beneath him, buried under the snow, yet even through the frozen barrier, Kessel felt the life-giving glow of its warmth. He dug. Visually guiding hands that could not feel their work, he dug for his life. And then he came upon something solid and felt the heat intensify. Scrambling to push the remaining snow away from it, he managed at last to pull it free. He couldn't understand what he was seeing. He blamed it on delirium. In his frozen hands, Akar Kessel held what appeared to be a square-sided icicle. Yet its warmth flowed through him, and he felt the tingles again, this time signaling the rebirth of his extremities. Kessel had no idea what was happening, and he didn't care in the least. For now he had found hope for life, and that was enough. He hugged the crystal shard to his chest and moved back toward the rocky wall of the dell, searching out the most sheltered area he could find. Under a small overhang, huddled in a small area where the heat of the crystal had pushed the snow away, Akar Kessel survived his first night in the spine of the world. His bedfellow was the crystal shard, Crenshinabon, an ancient, sentient relic that had waited throughout ages uncounted for one such as he to appear in the bowl. Awakened again, it was even now pondering the methods it would use to control the weak-willed Kessel. It was a relic enchanted in the earliest days of the world, a perversion that had been lost for centuries, to the dismay of those evil lords who sought its strength. Crinchinabon was an enigma, a force of the darkest evil that drew its strength from the light of day. It was an instrument of destruction, a tool for scrying, a shelter and home for those who would wield it. But foremost among the powers of Crinchinabon was the strength it imparted to its possessor. Akkar Kessel slept comfortably, unaware of what had befallen him. He knew only, and cared only, that his life was not yet at an end. He would learn the implications soon enough. He would come to understand that he would never again play the role of stooge to pretentious dogs like Elduluk, Dendibar the Mottled, and the others. He would become the Akkar Kessel of his own fantasies, and all would bow before him.
"Respect," he mumbled from within the depths of his dream, a dream that Crinchinabon was imposing upon him. Akkar Kessel, the tyrant of Icewind Dale.
Kessel awakened to a dawn that he thought he would never see. The crystal shard had preserved him through the night, yet it had done much more than simply prevent him from freezing. Kessel felt strangely changed that morning. The night before, he had been concerned only with the quantity of his life, wondering how long he could merely survive. But now he pondered the quality of his life. Survival was no longer a question. He felt strength flowing within him. A white deer bounded along the rim of the bowl.
"Venison," Kessel whispered aloud.
He pointed a finger in the direction of his prey and spoke the command words of a spell, tingling with excitement as he felt the power surge through his blood. A searing white bolt shot out from his hand, felling the heart where it stood.
"Venison," he declared,
mentally lifting the animal through the air toward him without a second thought to the act, though telekinesis was a spell that hadn't even been in the considerable repertoire of Morkai the Red, Kessel's sole teacher. Though the shard would not have let him, Kessel the Greedy did not stop to ponder the sudden appearance of abilities he'd felt long overdue him. Now he had food and warmth from the shard, yet a wizard should have a castle, he reasoned, a place where he might practice his darkest secrets undisturbed. He looked to the shard for an answer to his dilemma, and found a duplicate crystal laying next to the first. Instinctively, so he presumed, though in reality it was another subconscious suggestion from Crinchinabon that guided him, Kessel understood his role in fulfilling his own request. He knew the original shard at once from the warmth and strength that it exuded, but this second one intrigued him as well, holding an impressive aura of power of its own. He took up the copy of the shard and carried it to the center of the bowl, setting it down on the deep snow.
"Ipsum dal abdur,"
he mumbled without knowing why or even what it meant. Kessel backed away as he felt the force within the image of the relic began to expand. It caught the rays of the sun and drew them within its depths. The area surrounding the bowl fell into shadow as it stole the very light of day. It began to pulse with an inner, rhythmic light. And then it began to grow. It widened at the base, nearly filling the bowl, and for a while Kessel feared that he would be crushed against the rocky walls. And in accordance with the crystal's widening, its tip rose up into the morning sky, keeping the dimensions aligned with its power source. Then it was complete, still an exact image of Crinchinabon, but now of mammoth proportions. A crystalline tower. Somehow, the same way Kessel knew anything about the crystal shard, he knew its name. Kreishal Tirith. Kessel would have been contented, for the time being at least, to remain in Kreishal Tirith and feast off of the unfortunate animals that wandered by. He had come from a meager background of unambitious peasants, and though he outwardly boasted of aspirations beyond his station, he was intimidated by the implications of power. He didn't understand how or why those who had gained prominence had risen above the common rabble, and even lied to himself, passing off the accomplishments of others and, conversely, the lack of his own, as a random choice of fate. Now that he had power within his grasp, he had no notion of what to do with it. But Crenshinabon had waited too long to see its return to life wasted as a hunting lodge for a puny human. Kessel's wishy-washiness was actually a favorable attribute from the relic's perspective. Over a period of time, it could persuade Kessel to follow almost any course of action with its nighttime messages. And Crenshinabon had the time. The relic was anxious to again taste the thrill of conquest, but a few years did not seem long to an artifact that had been created at the dawn of the world. It would mold the bumbling Kessel into a proper representative of its power, nurture the weak man into an iron-fisted glove to deliver its message of destruction. It had done likewise 100 times in the initial struggles of the world, creating and nurturing some of the most formidable and cruel opponents of law across any of the planes. It could do so again. That very night, Kessel, sleeping in the comfortably adorned second level of Kryshal Tirith, had dreams of conquest. Not violent campaigns waged against a city such as Luskin, or even on the scale of battle against a frontier settlement like the villages of Ten Towns, but a less ambitious and more realistic start to his kingdom. He dreamed that he had forced a tribe of goblins into servitude, using them to assume the roles as his personal staff, catering to his every need. When he awakened the next morning, he remembered the dream and found that he liked the idea. Later that morning, Kessel explored the third level of the tower, a room like all the others, made of smooth yet stone-strong crystal, this particular one filled with various scrying devices. Suddenly, an urge came over him to make a certain gesture and speak an arcane word of command that he assumed he must have heard in the presence of Morkai. He complied with the feeling and watched in amazement as the dimension within the depths of one of the mirrors in the room suddenly swirled in a gray fog. When the fog cleared, an image came into focus. Kessel recognized the area depicted as a valley he had passed a short distance down the trail, when Eldaluk, Dendibar the Mottled, and the others had left him to die. The image of the region was bustling with a tribe of goblins at work constructing a campsite. These were nomads, probably, for war bands rarely brought females and young ones along on their raids. Hundreds of caves dotted the sides of these mountains, but they weren't numerous enough to hold the tribes of orcs, goblins, ogres, and even more powerful monsters. Competition for lairs was fierce, and the lesser goblin tribes were usually forced above ground, enslaved, or slaughtered.
"How convenient," Kessel mused, wondering if the subject of his dream had been a coincidence or a prophecy. On another sudden impulse, he sent his will through the mirror toward the goblins. The effect startled him. As one, the goblins turned, apparently confused, in the direction of the unseen force. The warriors apprehensively drew their clubs and stone-headed axes, and the females and children huddled in the back of the group. One larger goblin, the leader presumably, holding its club defensively before it, took a few cautious steps ahead of its soldiers. Kessel scratched his chin, pondering the extent of his newfound power.
"Come to me," he called to the goblin chieftain. "You cannot resist."
The tribe arrived at the bowl a short time later, remaining a safe distance away while they tried to figure out exactly what the tower was and where it had come from. Kessel let them marvel over the splendor of his new home, then called again to the chieftain, compelling the goblin to approach Kryshal Tirith. Against its own will, the large goblin strode from the ranks of the tribe. Fighting every step, it walked right up to the base of the tower. It couldn't see any door, for the entrance to Kryshal Tirith was invisible to all except denizens of foreign planes and those that Crenshinabon, or its wielder, allowed to enter. Kessel guided the terrified goblin into the first level of the structure. Once inside, the chieftain remained absolutely motionless, its eyes darting around nervously for some indication of the overpowering force that had summoned it to this structure of dazzling crystal. The wizard, a title rightfully imparted to the possessor of Crenshinabon, even if Kessel had never been able to earn it by his own deeds. Let the miserable creature wait for a while, heightening its fear. Then he appeared at the top of the stairwell through a secret mirror door. He looked down upon the wretched creature and cackled with glee. The goblin trembled visibly when it saw Kessel. It felt the wizard's will imposing upon it once again, compelling the creature to its knees.
"Who am I?"
Kessel asked as the goblin groveled and whimpered. The chieftain's reply was torn from within by a power that it could not resist.
"Master!"
5. Someday. Brunner walked up the rocky slope with measured steps, his boots finding the same footholds he always used when he ascended to the high point of the southern end of the Dwarven Valley. To the people of Ten Towns, who often saw the dwarf standing meditatively on the perch, this high column of stones in the rocky ridge that lined the valley had come to be known as Brunner's Climb. Just below the dwarf to the west were the lights of Tourmaline, and beyond them the dark waters of Mare Dualden, spotted occasionally by the running lights of a fishing boat whose resolute crew stubbornly refused to come ashore until they had landed a knucklehead. The dwarf was well above the tundra floor and the lowest of the countless stars that sparkled the night. The celestial dome seemed polished by the chill breeze that had blown since sunset, and Brunner felt as though he had escaped the bonds of earth. In this place he found his dreams, and ever they took him back to his ancient home, Mithril Hall, home of his fathers and theirs before them, where rivers of the shining metal ran rich and deep, and the hammers of dwarven smiths rang out in praise to Moradin and Dumathoin. Brunner was merely an unbearded boy when his people had delved too deep into the bowels of the world, and had been driven out by the dark things in dark holes. He was now the eldest surviving member of his small clan, and the only one among them who had witnessed the treasures of Mithril Hall. They had made their home in the rocky valley between the two northernmost of the three lakes long before any humans, other than the barbarians, had come to Icewind Dale. They were a poor remnant of what had once been a thriving dwarven society, a band of refugees beaten and broken by the loss of their homeland and heritage. They continued to dwindle in numbers, their elders dying as much of sadness as of old age. Though the mining under the fields of the region was good, the dwarves seemed destined to fade away into oblivion. When Ten Towns had sprung up, though, the luck of the dwarves rose considerably. Their valley was just north of Bryn Shander, as close to the principal city as any of the fishing villages, and the humans, often warring with each other and fighting off invaders, were happy to trade for the marvelous armor and weapons that the dwarves forged. But even with the betterment of their lives, Brunner, particularly, longed to recover the ancient glory of his ancestors. He viewed the arrival of Ten Towns as a temporary stay from a problem that would not be resolved until Mithril Hall had been recovered and restored.
"A cold night for so high a perch, good friend," came a call from behind.
The dwarf turned around to face Driz Doerden, though he realized that the drow would be invisible against the black backdrop of Kelvin's cairn. From this vantage point, the mountain was the only silhouette that broke the featureless line of the northern horizon. The cairn had been so named because it resembled a mound of purposely piled boulders. Barbarian legend claimed that it truly served as a grave. Certainly, the valley where the dwarves now made their home did not resemble any natural landmark. In every direction, the tundra rolled on, flat and earthen. But the valley had only sparse patches of dirt sprinkled in among broken boulders and walls of solid stone. It, and the mountain on its northern border, were the only features in all of Icewind Dale with any mentionable quantities of rock, as if they had been misplaced by some god in the earliest days of creation. Driz noted the glazed look of his friend's eyes.
"You seek the sights that only your memory can see," he said,
well aware of the dwarf's obsession with his ancient homeland.
"A sight I'll see again," Brunner insisted. "We'll get there, Elf."
"We do not even know the way."
"Roads can be found," said Brunner, "but not until ye look for them."
"Someday, my friend," Driz humored. In the few years that he and Brunner had been friends, the dwarf had constantly badgered Driz about accompanying him on his adventure to find Mithril Hall. Driz thought the idea foolish, for no one that he had ever spoken with had even a clue as to the location of the ancient dwarven home, and Brunner could only remember disjointed images of the silvery halls. Still, the drow was sensitive to his friend's deepest desire, and he always answered Brunner's pleas with a promise of someday.
"We have more urgent business at the moment," Drizzt reminded Brunner.
Earlier that day, in a meeting in the Dwarven Halls, the drow had detailed his findings to the dwarves.
"You're sure they'll be coming, then?" Brunner asked now.
"Their charge will take the stones of Kelvin's cairn," Drizzt replied as he left the darkness of the mountain silhouette and joined his friend. "And if Ten Towns does not stand united against them, the people are doomed."
Brunner settled into a crouch and turned his eyes to the south, toward the distant lights of Bryn Shander.
"They'll not, the stubborn fools," he muttered.
"They might, if your people went to them."
"No," growled the dwarf. "We'll fight beside them if they choose to stand together, and pity then to the barbarians. Go to them if ye wish, and good luck to ye, but nothing of the dwarves. Let us see what grit and guts the fisherfolk can muster."
Drizzt smiled at the irony of Brunner's refusal. Both of them knew well that the drow was not trusted, not even openly welcomed, in any of the towns other than Lonelywood, where their friend Regis was spokesman. Brunner marked the drow's look, and it pained him as it pained Drizzt, though the elf stoically pretended otherwise.
"They owe ye more than they'll ever know,"
Brunner stated flatly, turning a sympathetic eye on his friend.
"They owe me nothing."
Brunner shook his head.
"Why do ye care?" he growled. "Ever you're watching over the folk that show ye no goodwill. What do ye owe to them?"
Drizzt shrugged, hard-pressed to find an answer. Brunner was right. When the drow had first come to this land, the only one who had shown him any friendship at all was Regis. He often escorted and protected the halfling through the dangerous first legs of the journey from Lonelywood, around the open tundra north of Mare Dualden, and down toward Bryn Shander. When Regis went to the principal city for business or council meetings, they had actually met on one such trek. Regis tried to flee from Drizzt because he'd heard terrible rumors about him. Luckily for both of them, Regis was a halfling who was usually able to keep an open mind about people and make his own judgments concerning their character. It wasn't long before the two were fast friends. But to this day, Regis and the dwarves were the only ones in the area who considered the drow a friend.
"I do not know why I care," Drizzt answered honestly.
His eyes turned back to his ancient homeland, where loyalty was merely a device to gain an advantage over a common foe.
"Perhaps I care because I strive to be different from my people," he said, as much to himself as to Brunner. "Perhaps I care because I am different from my people. I may be more akin to the races of the surface, that is my hope at least. I care because I have to care about something."
"You are not so different, Brunner Battlehammer. We care lest our own lives be empty." Brunner cocked a curious eye.
"You can deny your feelings for the people of Ten Towns to me, but not to yourself."
"Bah!" Brunner snorted. "Sure that I care for them. My folk need the trade."
"Stubborn," Drizzt mumbled, smiling knowingly. "And Catty Bree?" he pressed. "What of the human girl who was orphaned in the raid those years ago on Tourmaline, the waif that you took in and raised as your own child?"
Brunner was glad that the cover of night offered some protection from his revealing blush.
"She lives with you still, though even you would have to admit that she is able to go back to her own kind. Might it be, perhaps, that you care for her, gruff dwarf?"
"Ah, shut your mouth," Brunner grumbled. "She's a servant wench and makes my life a bit easier. But don't ye go getting sappy about her."
"Stubborn," Drizzt reiterated more loudly this time.
He had one more card to play in this discussion.
"What of myself, then? Dwarves are not overly fond of the light elves, let alone the drow. How do you justify the friendship you have shown me? I have nothing to offer you in return but my own friendship. Why do you care?"
"Ye bring me news when—"
Brunner stopped short, aware that Drizzt had cornered him. But the drow didn't press the issue any further. So the friends watched in silence as the lights of Bryn Shander went down, one by one. Despite his outward callousness, Brunner realized how true some of the drow's accusations had rung.
He had come to care for the people who had settled on the banks of the Three Lakes.
"What do you mean to do, then?"
the dwarf asked at length.
"I mean to warn them," Drizzt replied. "You underestimate your neighbors, Brunner. They're made of tougher stuff than you believe."
"Agreed," said the dwarf. "But my questions are of their character. Every day we see fighting on the lakes, and always over the damned fish. The people cling to their own towns, and goblins take the others for all they care. Now they've to show me and mine that they've the will to fight together."
Drizzt had to admit the truth of Brunner's observations. The fishermen had grown more competitive over the last couple of years as the knucklehead trout took to the deeper waters of the lakes and became harder to catch. Cooperation among the towns was at a low point as each town tried to gain an economic advantage over the rival towns on its lake. "There is a council in Bryn Shander in 2 days," Drizzt continued. "I believe that we still have some time before the barbarians come. Though I fear for any delays, I do not believe that we would be able to bring the spokesmen together any sooner. It will take me that long to properly instruct Regis on the course of action that he must take with his peers, for he must carry the tidings of the coming invasion."
"Rumblebelly?"
snorted Brunner, using the name he had tagged on Regis for the halfling's insatiable appetite.
"He sits on the council for no better reason than to keep his stomach well stocked. They'll hear him less than they'd hear yourself, elf."
"You underestimate the halfling, more so even than you underestimate the people of Ten Towns," answered Drizzt. "Remember always that he carries the stone."
"Bah, a fine-cut gem, but no more," Brunner insisted. "I've seen it meself, and it holds no spell on me."
"The magic is too subtle for the eyes of a dwarf, and perhaps not strong enough to penetrate your thick skull," laughed Drizzt. "But it is there. I see it clearly and know the legend of such a stone. Regis may be able to influence the council more than you would believe, and certainly more than I could." "Let us hope so, for you know as well as I that some of the spokesmen might be reluctant to pursue any plan of unity, whether in their arrogant independence or in their belief that a barbarian raid upon some of their less protected rivals might actually help their own selfish ambitions. Bryn Shander remains the key. But the principal city will only be spurred to action if the major fishing towns, Targos in particular, join in."
"Ye know that Easthaven'll help," said Brunner. "They're ever ones for bringing all of the towns together."
"And Lonelywood, too, with Regis speaking for them. But Kemp of Targos surely believes that his walled city is powerful enough to stand alone, whereas its rival, Tourmaline, would be hard-pressed to hold back the horde."
"He's not likely to join anything that includes Tourmaline. And you're in for more trouble then, Drow, for without Kemp, you'll never get Koenig and Denival to shut up."
"But that is where Regis comes in," Drizzt explained. "The ruby he possesses can do wondrous things, I assure you."
"Again ye speak of the power of the stone," Brunner said. "But Rumblebelly claims that his master of old had 12 of the things," he reasoned. "Mighty magics don't come in dozens."
"Regis said that his master had 12 similar stones," Drizzt corrected. In truth, the halfling had no way of knowing if all 12 or any of the others were magical.
"Then why would the man have given the only one a power to Rumblebelly?"
Drizzt left the question unanswered, but his silence soon led Brunner to the same inescapable conclusion. Regis had a way of collecting things that didn't belong to him. And though the halfling had explained the stone as a gift. 6. Bryn Shander. Bryn Shander was unlike any of the other communities of Ten Towns. Its proud pennant flew high from the top of a hill in the middle of the dry tundra between the Three Lakes, just south of the southern tip of the Dwarven Valley. No ships flew the flags of this city, and it had no docks on any of the lakes. Yet there was little argument that it was not only the geographical hub of the region, but the center of activity as well. This was where the major merchant caravans from Luskin put in, where the dwarves came to trade, and where the vast majority of craftsmen, scrimshanders, and scrimshaw evaluators were housed. Proximity to Bryn Shander was second only to the quantity of fish hooked in determining the success and size of the fishing towns.
Thus, Tamerlane and Targos on the southeastern banks of Mare Dualden, and Caer Conig and Caer Dinneval on the western shores of Lac Dinashir, four towns less than a day's journey from the principal city, were the dominant towns on the lakes. High walls surrounded Bryn Shander, as much protection from the biting wind as from invading goblins or barbarians. Inside, the buildings were similar to those of the other towns, low, wooden structures, except that in Bryn Shander they were more tightly packed together and often subdivided to house several families. Congested as it was, though, there was a measure of comfort and security in the city, the largest taste of civilization a person could find for 400 long and desolate miles. Regis always enjoyed the sounds and smells that greeted him when he walked through the iron-bound wooden gates on the northern wall of the principal city. Though on a smaller scale than the great cities of the south, the bustle and shouts of Bryn Shander's open markets and plentiful street vendors reminded him of his days back in Kalimport. And as in Kalimport, the people of Bryn Shander's streets were a cross-section of every heritage that the realms had to offer. Tall, dark-skinned desert folk mingled among fair-skinned travelers from the Moonshaze. The loud boasts of swarthy southerners and robust mountain men trading fanciful tales of love and battle in one of the many taverns echoed on nearly every street corner. And Regis took it all in, for though the location was changed, the noise remained the same. If he closed his eyes and he skipped along down one of the narrow streets, he could almost recapture the zest for life that he had known those years before in Kalimport. This time, though, the halfling's business was so grave that it dampened even his ever-lifted spirits. He had been horrified at the drow's grim news and was nervous about being the messenger who would deliver it to the council. Away from the noisy market section of the city, Regis passed the palatial home of Cassius, the spokesman of Bryn Shander. This was the largest and most luxurious building in all of Ten Towns, with a columned front and bas-relief artwork adorning all its walls. It had originally been built for the meetings of the ten spokesmen, but as interest in the councils had died away, Cassius, skilled in diplomacy and not above using strong-arm tactics, had appropriated the palace as his official residence and moved the council hall to a vacant warehouse tucked away in a remote corner of the city. Several of the other spokesmen had complained about the change, but though the fishing towns could often exert some influence on the principal city in matters of public concern, they had little recourse in an issue as trivial to the general populace as this. Cassius understood his city's position well and knew how to keep most of the other communities under his thumb. The militia of Bryn Shander could defeat the combined forces of any five of the other nine towns combined, and Cassius's officers held a monopoly on connections to the necessary marketplaces in the south. The other spokesmen might grumble about the change in the meeting place, but their dependence on the principal city would prevent them from taking any actions against Cassius. Regis was the last to enter the small hall. He looked around at the nine men who had gathered at the table and realized how out of place he truly was. He had been elected spokesman because nobody else in Lonelywood cared enough to want to sit on the council, but his peers had attained their positions through valorous and heroic deeds. They were the leaders of their communities, the men who had organized the structure and defenses of the towns. Each of these spokesmen had seen a score of battles and more, for goblin and barbarian raiders descended upon Ten Towns more often than sunny days. It was a simple rule of life in Icewind Dale that if you couldn't fight, you couldn't survive, and the spokesmen of the council were some of the most proficient fighters in all of Ten Towns. Regis had never been intimidated by the spokesman before, because normally he had nothing to say at council. Lonelywood, a secluded town hidden away in a small, thick wood of fir trees, asked for nothing from anyone. And with an insignificant fishing fleet, the other three towns it shared Mare Dualden with imposed no demands upon it. Regis never offered an opinion unless pressed, and had been careful always to cast his vote on an issue in the way of the general consensus. And if the council was split on an issue, Regis simply followed the lead of Cassius. In Ten Towns, one couldn't go wrong by following Bryn Shander. This day, though, Regis found that he was intimidated by the council. The grim news that he bore would make him vulnerable to their bullying tactics and often angry reprisals. he focused his attention on the two most powerful spokesmen, Cassius of Bryn Shander and Kemp of Targos, as they sat at the head of the rectangular table and chatted. Kemp looked the part of rugged frontiersman, not too tall but barrel-chested, with gnarled and knotted arms, and a stern demeanor that frightened friend and foe alike. Cassius, though, hardly seemed a warrior. He was small of frame, with neatly trimmed gray hair and a face that never showed a hint of stubble. His big, bright blue eyes forever seemed locked into an inner contentment. But anyone who had ever seen the spokesman from Bryn Shander raise a sword in battle or maneuver his charge on the field had no doubts concerning his fighting prowess or his bravery. Regis truly liked the man, yet he was careful not to fall into a situation that left him vulnerable. Cassius had earned a reputation for getting what he wanted at another's expense. "Come to order," Cassius commanded, rapping his gavel on the table. The host spokesman always opened the meeting with the formalities of order, reading of titles and official proposals that had originally been intended to give the council an aura of importance, impressing especially the ruffians that sometimes showed up to speak for the more remote communities. But now, with the degeneration of the council as a whole, the formalities of order served only to delay the end of the meeting, to the regret of all 10 spokesmen. Consequently, the formalities were pared down more and more each time the group gathered, and there had even been talk of eliminating them altogether. When the list had finally been completed, Cassius turned to the important issues. "The first item on the agenda," he said, hardly glancing at the notes that were laid out before him, "concerns the territorial dispute between the sister cities, Caer Conig and Caer Denethal, on Lac Dinashir. I see that Dorim Lugar of Caer Conig has brought the documents that he promised at the last meeting, so I turn the floor over to him. Spokesman Lugar." Dorim Lugar, a gaunt, dark-complected man whose eyes never seemed to stop darting about nervously, nearly leaped out of his chair when he was introduced. "I have in my hand," he yelled, his upraised fist closed about an old parchment, "the original agreement between Caer Conig and Caer Denethal, signed by the leaders of each town." He shot an accusing finger in the direction of the spokesman from Caer Denethal. "Including your own signature, Jensen Brent." "An agreement signed during a time of friendship and in the spirit of goodwill," retorted Jensen Brent, a younger golden-haired man with an innocent face that often gave him an advantage over people who judged him naive. "Unroll the parchment, Spokesman Lugar, and let the council view it. They shall see that it makes no provisions whatsoever for Easthaven." He looked around at the other spokesman. "Easthaven could hardly be called even a hamlet when the agreement to divide the lake in half was signed," he explained, and not for the first time. "They had not a single boat to put in the water." "Fellow spokesman," Dorim Lugar yelled, jolting some of them from the lethargy that had already begun to creep in. This same debate had dominated the last 4 councils with no ground gained by either side. The issue held little importance or interest for any but the 2 spokesmen and the spokesman from Easthaven. "Surely Caer Conig cannot be blamed for the rise of Easthaven," pleaded Dorim Lugar. "Who could have foreseen the Eastway?" he asked, referring to the straight and smooth road that Easthaven had constructed to Bryn Shander. It was an ingenious move and proved a boon to the small town on the southeastern corner of Lac Dinashir. Combining the appeal of a remote community with easy access to Bryn Shander had made Easthaven the fastest-growing community in all of 10 towns, with a fishing fleet that had swelled to nearly rival the boats of Caer Denethal. "Who indeed?" retorted Jensen Brent, now a bit of fluster showing through his calm facade. "It is obvious that Easthaven's growth has put Caer Denethal in stiff competition for the southern waters of the lake, while Caer Conig sails freely in the northern half. Yet Caer Conig has flatly refused to renegotiate the original terms to compensate for the imbalance. We cannot prosper under such conditions." Regis knew that he had to act before the argument between Brent and Lugar got out of control. 2 previous meetings had been adjourned because of their volatile debates, and Regis couldn't let this council disintegrate before he had told them of the impending barbarian attack. He hesitated, having to admit to himself once again that he had no options and could not back away from this urgent mission. His haven would be destroyed if he said nothing.
Although Drizzt had reassured him of the power he possessed, he retained his doubts about the true magic of the stone. Yet due to his own insecurity, a trait common among little folk, Regis found himself blindly trusting in Drizzt's judgment. The drow was possibly the most knowledgeable person he had ever known, with a list of experiences far beyond the tales that Regis could tell. Now was the time for action, and the halfling was determined to give the drow's plan a try. He closed his fingers around the little wooden gavel that was set out on the table before him. It felt unfamiliar to his touch, and he realized then that this was the first time that he had ever used the instrument. He tapped it lightly on the wooden table, but the others were intent on the shouting match that had erupted between Lugar and Brent. Regis reminded himself of the urgency of the drow's news once again and boldly pounded the gavel down. The other spokesmen turned immediately to the halfling, blank expressions stamped upon their faces. Regis rarely spoke at the meetings, and then only when cornered with a direct question. Cassius of Bryn Shander brought his heavy gavel down. "The council recognizes spokesman the spokesman from Lonelywood," he said. And from his uneven tone, Regis could guess that he had struggled to address the halfling's request for the floor seriously.
"Fellow spokesman,"
Regis began tentatively, his voice cracking into a squeak.
"With all due respect to the seriousness of the debate between the spokesman from Caer Dinnaval and Caer Conig, I believe that we have a more urgent problem to discuss."
Jensen Brent and Dorim Lugar were livid at being interrupted, but the others eyed the halfling curiously. "Good start," Regis thought. "I've got their full attention." He cleared his throat, trying to steady his voice and sound a bit more impressive.
"I have learned beyond doubt that the barbarian tribes are gathering for a united attack on 10 towns.
Though he tried to make the announcement dramatic, Regis found himself facing 9 apathetic and confused men.
"Unless we form an alliance," Regis continued in the same urgent tones, "the Horde will overrun our communities one by one, slaughtering any who dare to oppose them."
"Certainly, spokesman Regis of Lonelywood," said Cassius in a voice he meant to be calming, but was in fact condescending. "We have weathered barbarian raids before. There is no need for—"
"Not like this one," Regis cried. "All the tribes have come together. The raids before matched one tribe against one city, and usually we fared well. But how would Tourmaline or Caer Conig or even Bryn Shander stand against the combined tribes of Icewind Dale?"
Some of the spokesmen settled back into their chairs to contemplate the halfling's words. The rest began talking among themselves, some in great distress, some in angry disbelief. Finally, Cassius pounded his gavel again, calling the hall to silence. Then, with familiar bravado, Kemp of Targos slowly rose from his seat.
"May I speak, friend Cassius?"
he said with unnecessary politeness.
"Perhaps I may be able to put this grave pronouncement in the proper light."
Regis and Drizzt had made some assumptions about alliances when they had planned the halfling's actions at this council. They knew that Easthaven, founded and thriving on the principle of brotherhood among the communities of 10 towns, would openly embrace the concept of a common defense against the barbarian horde. Likewise, Tourmaline and Lonelywood, the 2 most accessible and raided towns of the 10, would gladly accept any offers of help. Yet even spokesman Agorwal of Tourmaline, who had so much to gain from a defensive alliance, would hedge and hold his silence if Kemp of Targos refused to accept the plan. Targos was the largest and mightiest of the 9 fishing villages, with a fleet more than twice the size of the 2nd largest.
"Fellow members of the council,"
Kemp began, leaning forward over the table to loom larger in the eyes of his peers,
"let us learn more of the halfling's tale before we begin to worry. We have fought off barbarian invaders and worse enough times to be confident that the defenses of even the smallest of our towns are adequate."
Regis felt his tension growing as Kemp rolled into his speech, building on points designed to destroy the halfling's credibility. Drizzt had decided early on in their planning that Kemp of Targos was the key, but Regis knew the spokesman better than the drow and knew that Kemp would not be easily manipulated. Kemp illustrated the tactics of the powerful town of Targos in his own mannerisms.
He was large and bullying, often taking to sudden fits of violent rage that intimidated even Cassius. Regis had tried to steer Drizzt away from this part of their plan, but the Drow was adamant.
"If Targos agrees to accept the alliance with Lonelywood," Drizzt had reasoned, "Tourmaline will gladly join, and Bremen, being the only other village on the lake, will have no choice but to go along. Bryn Shander will certainly not oppose a unified alliance of the four towns on the largest and most prosperous lake, and Easthaven will make 6 in the pact, a clear majority. The rest would then have no choice but to join in the effort." Drizzt had believed that Caer Dinnaval and Caer Conic, fearing that Easthaven would receive special consideration in future councils, would put on a blusterous show of loyalty, hoping themselves to gain favor in the eyes of Cassius. Good Mead and Dugan's Hole, the two towns on Redwaters, though relatively safe from an invasion from the north, would not dare to stand apart from the other 8 communities. But all of this was merely hopeful speculation, as Regis clearly realized when he saw Kemp glaring at him from across the table. Drizzt had conceded the point that the greatest obstacle in forming the alliance would be Targos. In its arrogance, the powerful town might believe that it could withstand any barbarian raid, and if it did manage to survive, the destruction of some of its competitors might actually prove profitable.
"You say only that you have learned of an invasion," Kemp began. "Where could you have gathered this valuable and no doubt hard-to-find information?"
Regis felt sweat beating on his temples. He knew where Kemp's question would lead, but there was no way that he could avoid the truth.
"From a friend who often travels the tundra," he answered honestly.
"The drow?"
Kemp asked. With his neck bent up and Kemp towering over him, Regis found himself quickly placed on the defensive. The halfling's father had once warned him that he would always be at a disadvantage when dealing with humans, because they physically had to look down when speaking to him as they would to their own children. At times like this, the words of his father rang painfully true to Regis. He wiped a bead of moisture from his upper lip.
"I cannot speak for the rest of you,"
Kemp continued, adding a chuckle to place the halfling's grave warning in an absurd light.
"But I have too much serious work to do to go into hiding on the words of a drow elf."
Again the burly spokesman laughed, and this time he was not alone. A Gorwell of Tourmaline offered some unexpected assistance to the halfling's failing cause.
"Perhaps we should let the spokesman from Lonelywood continue, if his words are true."
"His words are the echoes of a drow's lies,"
Kemp snarled.
"Pay them no heed. We have fought off the barbarians before, and—"
But then Kemp, too, was cut short as Regis suddenly sprang up on the council table. This was the most precarious part of Drizzt's plan. The drow had shown faith in it, describing it matter-of-factly, as though it would pose no problems. But Regis felt impending disaster hovering all about him. He clasped his hands behind his head and tried to appear in control so that Cassius wouldn't take any immediate actions against his unusual tactics. During Agarwal's diversion, Regis had slipped the ruby pendant out from under his waistcoat. It sparkled on his chest as he walked up and down, treating the table as though it were his personal stage.
"What do you know of the drow to jest of him so?"
he demanded of the others, pointedly Kemp.
"Can any of you name a single person that he has harmed? No. You chastise him for the crimes of his race, yet have none of you ever considered that Drizzt O'Urden walks among us because he has rejected the ways of his people?"
The silence in the hall convinced Regis that he had either been impressive or absurd. In any case, he was not so arrogant or foolish to think his little speech sufficient to accomplish the task. He walked over to face Kemp. This time, he was the one looking down, but the spokesman from Targos seemed on the verge of exploding into laughter. Regis had to act quickly. He bent down slightly and raised his hand to his chin, by appearance to scratch an itch, though in truth to set the ruby pendant spinning, tapping it with his arm as it passed. He then held the silence of the moment patiently and counted as Drizzt had instructed. 10 seconds passed, and Kemp had not blinked. Drizzt had said that this would be enough, but Regis, surprised and apprehensive at the ease with which he had accomplished the task, let another 10 go by before he dared begin testing the drow's beliefs.
Surely you can see the wisdom of preparing for an attack, Regis suggested calmly.
Then, in a whisper that only Kemp could hear, he added,
These people look to you for guidance, Great Kemp. A military alliance would only enhance your stature and influence.
The effect was dazzling.
Perhaps there is more to the halfling's words than we first believed,
Kemp said mechanically, his glazed eyes never leaving the ruby. Stunned, Regis straightened up and quickly slipped the stone back under his waistcoat. Kemp shook his head as though clearing a confusing dream from his thoughts, and he rubbed his dried eyes. The spokesman from Targos couldn't seem to recall the last few moments, but the halfling's suggestion was planted deeply into his mind. Kemp found, to his own amazement, that his attitudes had changed.
"We should hear well the words of Regis," he declared loudly, "for we shall be none the worse from forming such an alliance, yet the consequences of doing nothing may prove to be grave indeed."
Quick to seize an advantage, Jensen Brent leaped up from his chair.
"Spokesman Kemp speaks wisely," he said. "Number the people of Caer Dinnaval, ever proponents of the united efforts of 10 towns, among the army that shall repel the horde."
The rest of the spokesmen lined up behind Kemp, as Drizzt had expected, with Doram Lugar making an even bigger show of loyalty than Brent's. Regis had much to be proud of when he left the council hall later that day, and his hopes for the survival of 10 towns had returned. Yet the halfling found his thoughts consumed by the implications of the power he had discovered in his ruby. He worked to figure the most fail-safe way in which he could turn this newfound power of inducing cooperation into profit and comfort.
"So nice of the Pasha Pook to give me this one," he told himself as he walked through the front gate of Bryn Shander and headed for the appointed spot where he would meet with Drizzt and Brunner.
7. The Coming Storm. They started at dawn, charging across the tundra like an angry whirlwind. Animals and monsters alike, even the ferocious yetis, fled before them in terror. The frozen ground cracked beneath the stamp of their heavy boots, and the murmur of the endless tundra wind was buried under the strength of their song, the song to the god of battle. They marched long into the night and were off again before the first rays of dawn. More than 2,000 barbarian warriors hungry for blood and victory. Drizzt O'Urden sat nearly halfway up on the northern face of Kelvin's cairn, his cloak pulled tight against the bitter wind that howled through the boulders of the mountain. The drow had spent every night up here since the council in Bryn Shander, his violet eyes scanning the blackness of the plain for the first signs of the coming storm. At Drizzt's request, Brunner had arranged for Regis to sit beside him. With the wind nipping at him like an invisible animal, the halfling squeezed in between two boulders as further protection from the unwelcoming elements. Given a choice, Regis would have been tucked away into the warmth of his own soft bed in Lonelywood, listening to the quiet moan of the swaying tree branches beyond his warm walls. But he understood that, as a spokesman, everyone expected him to help carry out the course of action he had suggested at the council. It quickly became obvious to the other spokesman and to Brunner, who had joined in the subsequent strategy meetings as the representative of the dwarves, that the halfling wouldn't be much help in organizing the forces or drawing any battle plans. So when Drizzt told Brunner that he would need a courier to sit watch with him, the dwarf was quick to volunteer Regis. Now the halfling was thoroughly miserable. His feet and fingers were numbed from the cold, and his back ached from sitting against the hard stone. This was the third night out, and Regis grumbled and complained constantly, punctuating his discomfort with an occasional sneeze. Through it all, Drizzt sat unmoving and oblivious to the conditions, his stoic dedication to duty overriding any personal distress.
"How many more nights do we have to wait?" Regis whined. "One morning, I'm sure. Maybe even tomorrow, they'll find us up here, dead and frozen, to this cursed mountain."
"Fear not, little friend," Drizzt answered with a smile. "The wind speaks of winter. The barbarians will come all too soon, determined to beat the first snows. Even as he spoke, the drow caught the tiniest flicker of light in the corner of his eye. He rose from his crouch suddenly, startling the halfling, and turned toward the direction of the flicker, his muscles tensed with reflexive wariness, his eyes straining to spot a confirming sign.
"What's—"
Regis began, but Drizzt silenced him with an outstretched palm. A second dot of fire flashed on the edge of the horizon.
"You have gotten your wish," Drizzt said with certainty.
"Or the help